Hello, this show is pre-recorded. I'm Xavier Mejia with the LGBT Hero Awards. You'll be listening to the show on Sunday, May 17th, 2015. The hour is 10 a.m. You're listening to Queer Talk, an LGBT Hero Awards talk radio show. I'm your host, Xavier Mejia. The LGBT Hero Awards talk radio is a listener-funded progressive station that interviews guests from the world of entertainment, art, and community, politics, public health, and business. Joining me this morning is Karen Anzuategui. Oh, my God, I tried.
You were almost there again.
I don't know why I had such a hard time with your last name.
It is okay.
Sorry.
This is perfect. This is just how it is. You know, we have to get, you know, just used to how it flows.
Karen is here to speak about the latest production of the one-night show, Catholic School Days. This production is a 60-minute autobiographical solo play that tells the story of Karen, who was forced to attend a Catholic high school. Bullied by administrators and classmates alike, Karen is forced to make difficult decisions to survive school life, including making the decision of becoming a Catholic chola. Come on this journey of self-discovery and witness a new world of gender nonconforming. Good morning, Karen. How are you?
I am doing so well. Thank you so much for that introduction. That was beautiful.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. So I was reading a little bit about your bio. I know, you know, we've had you on the show before, so welcome back. But I was taking the time to do some more studying about who you are, and I was reading that you are a genderqueer writer, performer, and activist, and emerging gender and queer solo performer in here in LA. So I saw that you received a BA from Loyola Marymount University, and that you published Ana Castillo's La Tolteca online, how do we say that, online zine with an essay on performance. So that, I mean, come on, like, for me to be able just to introduce you like that, my goodness, I'm sure that's been a journey, that's been a long road. So give us a little bit about who you are. Share with our audience your background. Where did you grow up? How did you sort of arrive to this queer artist space? Yeah, share with us a little bit more about who you are.
Whoa. Yeah, a lot of things. So thank you so much for researching there and reading about, you know, my bio there and the yeah, definitely where I'm. We always love to claim in LA, right? Because we do. Where are you from? Like, yeah. I grew up in Huntington Park, and also in Buenos Aires and Asunción. There's times that I went and visited there a lot as a child, and that really did inform my journey. Mm-hmm. Of course, it shaped me as a human being. So this traveling back and forth as a child was wonderful, and but I did grow up in Huntington Park for a while, and I even went to Baptist school, which is interesting because of the whole play Catholic School Days now. But you know, we moved around, we traveled. I lived in Argentina for some time. A lot of abuse in my family, so we escaped that. It was almost like the migrating back and forth was for many reasons. And a safe haven, you know, so I felt very much like Buenos Aires, like welcomed me and embraced me during difficult times of my childhood. I continued in different parts of LA, like San Gabriel Valley also, and I went to high school in La Puente. Mm. So I did also live in Moreno Valley. So it was like all these areas of escaping, trying to escape, you know, violence, and resettling into different areas, you know. And I did so even when my mother and my family migrated back to South America. So I still continue my journey here. And so this sort of like embodying different identities. I have many communities I belong to and I identify with and I embrace. And so it's been like a wonderful journey. Like what led me to like be meeting Ana Castillo to begin with, you know, and being able to work with Alicia Gaspar del Alba and Alma Lopez. And it was just it's just been fantastic. And my work with HIV or HIV work has brought me to so many different like levels of life and and appreciating life in so many different ways and being able to be of service to others, to really almost be like grounded in a way in my existence in a different way, because I trained as an actor for so long, you know, I've trained in so many different classic work and just street theater, like just different, you know, making my own shows, being tired of not getting cast because of my gender identity, which I'm glad that you pointed out. Last time I was here, I forgot.
Well, that's what I'm here for. So you're a citizen of the world, you know, and I know that we had talked before the first show, and so we have that in common. I'm also from the SGV, and so you spent some time there, and that's where you went to school and were, you know, had these experiences that now you talk about in Catholic School Days. But does Catholic School Days also encompass other school life outside of the San Gabriel Valley?
At the time, my gender identity was her, she, and mine now is they, them. So I guess at the time, it was taking only in place in that world of San Gabriel Valley and also in the world of her, not knowing anything else.
For, you know, our listeners, you know, we have several listeners across the U.S. So for our listeners who haven't had the experience of hearing about gender nonconforming and, you know, using the idea of using pronouns that, or not using pronouns, you know, can you give us a little bit of background having had that firsthand experience yourself with the, you know, experience of wanting to re-identify? Can you share with our audience what does that process look like? What is it that you're talking about?
Well, once I figured sexuality and gender are separate, it made more sense to me as to why and how I identified within, and that being that sometimes it's fluid. Sometimes my gender is very much feminine. Sometimes it's more masculine, and I change. Like it's fluid. I feel that shift happening. Not maybe as it is like, oh, the shift is happening. But like, whoa, do you feel that wave right there?
There's no gears.
Yeah. It's sort of just like a state of being, that it's a mind and how I embody myself, how I'm expressing myself, how I'm thinking, everything. And so I don't identify he because I do feel that I am fluid. So it's not either or. It's sort of everything at once.
And what experiences led to, you know, looking at yourself differently than, you know, this traditional idea of gender identity?
I think it's always happened. I've always wanted to be, when I was a child, I felt totally different. I was always placed in a dress. My mother is a seamstress. My godmother was a seamstress. And so they always wanted to dress me up. And I did not want to be the traditional girl, which was wear these dresses, be cute, walk the catwalk. I modeled when I was four for like different little like events and fashion shows for like different types of stores. And like, I don't know. I think I embraced my femininity, but I also knew that like there was something else. And I know that there's trauma from it because it was this idea of like feeling like I can't be masculine identified. Mm-hmm. That only goes so far as being a tomboy. And I I thought maybe, okay, I'm a tomboy. So it was like this whole idea of like, I'm not this feminine pretty girl ever. And when I became an actor, you know, like training, it's like, okay, I'm only going to play the funny one. I'm only going to play like the quirky one. I'm going to only play this like really like these character roles and stuff, because it can never be considered for these types of love interests and these kinds of roles. And so it being younger and feeling this way, it changed over time when I decided to be more myself, right? When I was embracing more of beyond, you know, this idea of being queer, this idea of, you know, it's only about loving women if you're a woman. And it is for a lot of people, but for myself, you know, some people don't identify in the gender identity I do, but they understand what it's like to be queer. And
and just for the listeners who, again, this is a new, you know, language and may not be exposed, and potentially, you know, some of our listeners could be, you know, young people themselves who are having these questions. So what is different about being a gender nonconformist and someone that may identify as heterosexual or gay or lesbian or even transgender? What's the distinction here?
Well, I can only speak for myself, of course. A lot of times people like to say, what is it for everybody? I believe that I'm trained, like a lot of people have been conditioned in that way, to think it's either this, either that. Please tell me, so that I can just have a little box in my head for everybody. And I think that box, that we do that just like almost naturally, is the issue that's hard to break out of, because that is the idea that we can only be a few things, and it could have to be logic. It has to process through someone else's mind in order to make us legitimate.
Right.
And so that's like a really important thing to look at. For myself, as far as like gender, being queer for myself embraces both gender and sexual identity. There are, you know, others that identify as lesbians, you know, bisexual, and, well, transgender, and there's trans queer, queer trans. It's just different for everybody as far as their, what they feel is their identity. Like, this is, you know, and this language, you know, is fits what I sense and what I'm feeling on an everyday basis, and it changes too. So what, you know, one could be maybe queer in their gender, being fluid or non-conforming, using those words to identify, you know, to describe gender, being queer or gender non-conforming, but it doesn't necessarily mean that, like, you know, it affects their sexuality. But it just depends on where that, you know, where I feel comfortable. And at this point, you know, it changes. It could change, you know, but I'm fluid, you know.
That's the part that really stands out the most to me, is the idea that we can all be fluid, and that we can identify in one situation and then re-identify again. And the truth is that, you know, we are all students of life, and we're all learning how to best express who we are. And, you know, when you're younger, it's so much more challenging to do so when you have people telling you what time you go to bed, what to wear, what to eat. You know, the structure is really put on by other people. So as we grow older, I think part of the empowerment is being able to hear these different messages and saying, oh, potentially I can identify in this one direction or in this other. And I remember when I was in my 20s, I met, you know, this person who's still a friend of mine, and, you know, would say, I'm pan-gender. And I was so fascinated by that idea, because I'd never heard that term up until then. And so I really had to think outside of the box. Like you said, there's these boxes that the people have created. So anything that, you know, allows us to think out of the box, I'm, you know, all for. And so thank you for sharing that with us. And this takes me to the next part of the interview that, you know, people best know you for a show named Serf. And the show's a queer transitional tale that was inspired by California immigration legislation, H.R. 4437, and a social manifestations in Argentina. So tell us a little bit about the how SED came to be, because it sounds like it has a lot to do with, you know, this identification and, once again, part of your journey. So I really like that we get to learn about, you know, these different shows. So talk to us a little bit about SED. I know it was a winner of two LA Weekly Awards for Best Original Music and Best Musical Direction. So, yeah, let's talk about SED.
Thank you. Yes, that it was a 9-year process, and it still is an ongoing process, as it will constantly be shifting, just like my identity, I suppose, or how it is, like, life. And theater is like life. So, but yeah, I was always constantly inspired and by this idea of migrating and being that, you know, my parents are immigrants, and I was constantly migrating as I was younger for many reasons. It was a huge part of my life and is part of my life. And when I went to Argentina in Buenos Aires, I would see the manifestations. I would see people on the streets protesting in a way that, as a child, I was not exposed to here in LA or being in Huntington Park, you know. And so it was a real big, like, eye-opener as a child. Like, what's going on? Like, what is... And it led me to be really interested in politics of why... is this happening, into finding out about Las Madres, and finding out and knowing there are women that are taking charge, that are saying, no, this is not okay. We are the people, and power to the people. Mm-hmm. And it was different here. You know, it was different. Being in Buenos Aires was like the epicenter of like these manifestations. And, you know, whenever we would go places, wherever we'd go, it was like loud and it was in your face. And that's it was scary. I mean, scary meaning because it's like, whoa, this is like really happening. And so when I wanted to write about that, I wanted to write about how these women, like, being power, like thinking that the United, you know, being in the U.S. is like completely free, that as a woman you're equal to men, and then coming to find out you're not.
Right, right. The reality
of the oppression, of women, the violence towards women, and just how it is, and seeing, you know, this in Argentina, you know, it's very sexualization of women and all that, and yes, but it's also this woman power, you know, And I see it, obviously, growing up, I see it in different ways here, and have many feminist friends, of course, and that. And I'm happy to be here at this time in life, this time period. So that, I needed to write about that. My aunt was a huge inspiration, though my aunts were, like, just seeing these women overcoming a lot of obstacles. And being like almost the head of household, you know, that was different in my household. Mm-hmm. You know, the abuse was there. We had to flee my father from, you know, the abuse he would have and over on us. And then this legislation also, of course, like our immigration reform, the constant, you know, forever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, going through Reagan and all of that as well. And coming to being this identity of me wanting to be part of the community here in a way that I felt I was ostracized in a way, or not feeling like a way in, because I'm Argentinian and a lot of people don't like Argentinians. So I felt a poster child of all of whatever that meant for people as I walked down the street. It would constantly change. So it was around me too, you know, people's idea of what it meant when I said where my family was from, or if I, you know, what that reaction was what I became to their eyes. And I wanted to connect with Latinos and Chicanas and politicized Chicanas. And I wanted to, like, come on, like, I we're one. Like, I know it's hard. I know it's hard. Can I find a community? Can I, And I wrote Sed, the beginnings of Sed, told through a soccer game, because I felt that every time I wore my soccer jersey, there was that dialogue of, what do I mean to others? Mm. What does this mean? How was I, you know, how was the world like? Almost kind of like how I felt in being identifying with multiple communities. It was also how it was coming to me. So I had all these different people telling me different things. So that was an interesting conversation starter. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to connect. And I did it, and I did it in Boyle Heights. I thought I was going to be booed off stage, or like, I don't know, you know, you're always like your own words, talking right. about the culture clashes, like the issues between us, and through a game of soccer, and it could be difficult, you know, but I found a lot of connection, actually, and a lot of people understanding, being able to need that humor to laugh about certain issues that happen between us, mm-hmm. and in a way that's embracing, like a way that is like, can I just hug people, like, and you know, and it's also coming to learn that not everyone will like you, not everybody will like me, you know, and that's okay. And as a child growing up in the environment I was, like, I learned why I am the way I am, you know, and through theater I found that out too, and so that's why I wrote it. The manifestations that happen here, like the amount of radio presence and violin, and like all of these, all kinds of immigrants coming out to the protests, to me was just like, instantly I want to cry. Mm-hmm. I was just like, oh my gosh, I'd wear my shirt, and actually people would have a conversation with me, cheering me on, like we would cheer each other on. We're true solidarity, where, you know, I thought maybe it wouldn't be, you know, sometimes because of just reactions I would get from the shirt, but it was like, no, we're here together. And I thought that was a beautiful thing, and I wanted to write about that, the experience at protests, and how it, to me, it's always been a beautiful thing, and not like a place of violence, but a soccer field, and what that meant at home, that was violent.
I know that in the show you do talk about sort of the different experience between the mother role and the father role in your life, and you do a good job at interpreting this through music, you know, taking your audience through the experience of depicting these two, you know, roles, these strong roles in your life through music. And there's, you know, some like James Brown in there. And, you know, so we see you in this sort of world where you are embracing this like inner, you know, soul kind of person in your body. How did you decide to include that into the show, and more so, why?
Well, the main reason is why the music. First, because my father is from Paraguay, is Guarani, and he, as we were growing up, learning, you know, listening to my father speak English as his third language, and was it could be, you know, we made fun of him as siblings, you know, mm-hmm. because we couldn't understand him when he spoke. And when we would see James Brown, he looked a little bit just kind of in the way he would carry himself, and his hair a little bit like the way he styled it in the 80s, and the way he walked, and he was a little bit chunkier back then, so he would kind of like the, you know, James Brown. And so I thought, you know, this is a good way to talk about the hard things to talk about, like mm-hmm. the abuse, like the, I don't want to be like, this is my dad and my dad's. It was like, I can't tell a story like this is not the way I can actually go on stage. This is like going to be boring, and not really boring. It's more like me, like it's not a story. It's not storytelling. It's like therapy. If I do that, I'm not going to do that to my audience. So, but it was a way that I needed to tell the story, but that I felt safe through this character that was larger than life, like the godfather of soul, like that. And to be able to tell that, it felt safe for me. Like, I can play this way. I can show you my heart through this way of comedy that is, you know, is like a parody in a way. The violence that exists in that sort of in my life, and in what you know of James Brown, and also in the misogynistic language and that type of character in a way, that has many reasons doing what they need to do. Not like I'm talking about James Brown, but, you know, like, I understand, like, there's many roles that also James Brown played in the 60s when the civil rights movement was happening, and Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, and he played a huge role in being able to use his music to speak to the people, bring people together. But I'm talking about my father, you know, so it's like this way of being able to do it. And the music sort of came, it was not going to be me. I didn't want to play James Brown. I didn't want to do this kind of stuff. It came by accident. It was all through mistakes. So all the time I would do my show, and maybe it was excerpts, maybe it was like in different weird ways. I did it in classrooms and in like conference settings and in a soccer field. Like I've done it, you know, while there were soccer games. It was very interesting, but not the best place maybe for a performance. But you learn a lot as you do it, and some things don't go right. Dang it, it doesn't go the way it's supposed to be. Well, that's a show directing me, telling me where it needs to be, and listen, let go. And it was like telling me, this is not a show that needs recorded music that you press cue. It is a live, breathing story, a living being as you're telling it, an experience for others. And it was like, I felt that it felt physically like I was wearing like something so constricting. And every time it messed up, and I won't ever forget when I was at Antioch University, and it was hooked up, like the sound was hooked up to the like the DJ. It was DJ White Apple. And I was like, what's up, DJ White Apple in the house? And but some of the sound cues weren't, there's a Mac and all that. And then right when they, you know, my the stage manager would press play, no sound would come out. And I basically was like, all right, y'all want to hear me sing some James Brown? People were like, yeah. And I just did it. And that is how that came to be. It was like, 7 years of doing the show without live music. And then finally, it was just the layer upon layer upon layer, the evolvement of the show, this being that keeps evolving. Right. And it's like, this is what I need now. And I'm like, okay. And I was so happy to have worked with Luis Perez of Los Lobos and David Hidalgo and doing this Evangeline, Queen of Make-Believe. And it's a play based on their songs and those local songs. And I invited Louis, who was in town, and some of the members of About, come and see my workshop of it at, or my show at the West Hollywood Library. They came in 2012. And so I was lucky that Louis Perez came because he loved the show. And then when I had the idea and a vision, a dream, I was giving it up at the end of 2012. I was like, I'm moving on. I'm going to go on to Catholic School Days. This show isn't going anywhere. I mean, it's like I've done this, but what do I do? Where else do I go? All this effort, all of this, like I produce my own shows. I write, I rewrite. It's like I hire people. I have all that work, you know. Mm-hmm. It's all of that work and doing all the service that I was doing. I didn't know when I was going to transition as a full-time artist. And it was like, oh, I'm doing all of this. How much longer can I keep this up? Everyone knows me as I constantly doing my show. Right, dang, right, but that's a lot of work. And you get older and you're like, what do I do? And so that's what happened.
No, I could see all the work that's gone into it. You know, it definitely feels like a masterpiece. So I could see why, hearing you speak, why this makes sense. You know, I could understand what you're saying about it's been an evolutionary process for the last 10 years. You know, as you speak about some heavy material during the show or interpret heavy material during the show, you know, it did feel therapeutic, you know, having experienced similar situations both at home and outside of the home. I tend to steer away from heavy things, you know, especially at this age. I found that as I was watching this, a show said that you know, because I YouTubed this.
Yeah.
Remember I was telling you the last time? I got to YouTube this. Let's see what's going on. I definitely felt more of a therapeutic process, even though I was experiencing, you know, seeing something that was, you know, difficult in my own life. I thought, okay, this is this type of storytelling through an artist is what makes the difference here, you know. And I think that, you know, art is such a vital part of healing, of growing, of developing emotional intelligence and, you know, just being creative people. Oh, that's the coffee letting us know it's done. but we could also say, hey, it's the timer. We need to probably think about, you know, Catholic school days a little bit. But I just love said so much that, you know, I just needed to touch on that a little bit more. But, okay, let's take that as a cue and transition into Catholic school days. because that too has been, you know, a work in progress, right?
Yeah, and I often like that sound. It is like a second child telling you, you have another one over here. Don't forget about me. So that's exactly what this is about
right,
here.
Right.
The show like this is telling us, we need this. Okay,
right,
here
right.
we go. And yes, this is a very microscopic look at a specific time period of my life in high school. I get to go back in time and play a high school student at Bishop Amat High School. And yes, I started this process. I was like, what do I want to write? I want to write another show, right? I'm ready to write my next show.
Mm-hmm.
I have that time to, I think, fit this in a seed. And I thought, well, immediately, what story? I'm like, this one inside of me is telling me I need to tell a story. Like, not many people know what happened. I don't really talk about this. I make up stories when people ask me about my scars on my arms. I just kind of was like, I think this is a good time in our history to be able to talk in human existence and time to talk about our next evolutionary step. And this, I am, you know, it's a lot of right-wing Christian conservative and people and throughout the world have been shaming, killing, you name it, to the LGBTQIA community, either gender-related or sexuality-related. And it was like a thing that I said, this is larger than me. I know I need to tell it, and I'm going to have to expose myself to do this. So here we go. Way to be naked in front of people, right? And so as a way that maybe I'm able to do this through, like before with James Brown, or being able to tell a story through this, these other ways, not just directly, like, so this is what happened, but it's an artistic way of, like, this elevated level, which allows the audience to also kind of go on that journey with you, and it becomes that therapeutic thing, connecting and witnessing story. I remember I was at Amita Swadin's event. It was a screening for sexual survivors, and she had mentioned that, and it, I learned through my community, too, you know. So she says, you know, witnessing the story is part of the healing process. And that is so true. I didn't, you know, I would do it. I just do it. Mm-hmm. I just don't have, sometimes don't have the language for it, right? Like sometimes others may be able to point it out from a different lens that they're coming through, looking through and being. So anyways, this play is in, all takes place in San Gabriel Valley. And it is of my high school, you know. But it started at this solo intensive writing that really got me to tell this story in a very comfortable way through Luis Alfaro's solo intensive class. And by doing that, the play started to come out, and we workshop them, keep writing. And then in 2012, performed it at Highways. And that, because of the response, I mean, you know, the response was just so tremendous. Like, the audience actually, after the show, came down and wouldn't let me. Like, it was almost like I couldn't go backstage. Like, it was, people had to hug me and touch me. It was just a very interesting experience
What are some of the experiences that you touch on during the show? You know, I guess what I'm trying to think of is when I look back at my high school years, I definitely have, it's sort of this linear experience, but it definitely is fragmented, right? It's, you know, and to a degree, it's fragmented by the year that, you know, the, you know, freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior experience. And it felt like an experience that definitely felt like a part of my own evolution process, right? But all of that I get, you know, I understand that part. So as an audience member, take us through sort of your journey. Like, what do you start to see? What do you first start to encounter that then dictates, you know, which direction you move forward towards?
In the storytelling?
Yeah.
Well, I was like, this particular event of being persecuted and being wrongly accused was, okay, this needs to be in there. Telling the story in the language was very particular, like in how I describe it, very much of a writer and writing imagery, like through imagery, through like pictures, you know, through my language. And so that allows for pictures to be told on stage in a way the images. And it lived that way as writing process. But then when I put it into my body, it becomes very rascuache. You know, because what do I need to tell the story? Oh, this becomes this. This thing becomes a microscope, you know, or this becomes, you know, in the science class, or this becomes. So I need what I need. I need to make it happen in that moment to become. And with the help of the director at the time was Marcos Najera, and we worked how to stage the piece with the world I was creating about life and about what happened to me, this trauma, and how. And the funny story, you know, and so I said, I need to embody, like, because in the writing, I'm following the steps of Jesus Christ, because I was all into the church.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to have this comical way of telling the story.
So there's a parallel story going on.
Yeah. So it's parallels into the Judas kiss, which is like the kiss that they accused me of having. And I'm like, what?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, how does that as a 15-year-old have, you know, how does that affect my mind?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then having to learn that the administration, which is like the reflection of the Catholic Church, is telling me and shaming me and accusing me of things and, you know, threatening me. And I'm like, I've just served, I don't know how many hundreds of hours of Christian service. Like,
I'm sure it must have felt like you were under the microscope a little bit.
Exactly. So thank you. So I use that imagery definitely for many ways of how I felt and trying to express it and to make the audience, allow the audience to feel what it could be like. And even though the audience may already know what that feels like, they're connecting to that. And also because the story I envisioned would be going to people who are conservative too. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking like larger, like leader, like who knows if it goes. And then there's someone in the audience that's conservative. You know, there's this need to tell this really, really image-based, you know, story. And using the iconography of Catholicism, and my idea of what that means if we reclaim it as queer people, in a way that's not according to this construct of the religion of what we do, but in a way that as queer people being not okay in that setting sometimes, like there's open MCC, you know, that kind of, you know, but more like in that traditional setting where you can't. And what does that look like if we did, you know? So
I'm sure that alone must feel empowering to say, you know, I'm being told to feel guilt. I'm being told to feel shame and to really question my decisions. And here you are so many years later telling a story and reclaiming your own story and saying, like, I don't want to trash anybody, but I need to at least heal, and healing means sharing. And I could see what you're talking about, how people who see this at the end may want to connect because they're already connecting to similarities, you know. excuse me. So when you decide to write your shows, is there a conscious process that includes, you know, wanting to mend the past or wanting to sort of heal from, you know, some, I don't know if tragedies are the right way to depict this, but challenges, some rough patches or difficulties, is as an artist, is that the goal, or are there several goals? Because it sounds like you know, it sounds like you want to take us somewhere, and I welcome being, you know, taken through the story. And so, and I'm fascinated with the notion of music always being a part of your storytelling. And so I'd like to hear a little bit about what is the mind of your artistry like, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely comes out of accident, like, right, pointing your where you need to be going. And so it was out of a need to perform, a need to be who I am, tell a story. Like, I was shamed for that when I was a child. So it's like, I would stutter, I would do all these things. So it was a way for me to know this is naturally who I am. I can't deny who I am. And so it's this need to tell a story, need to perform. But as an actor, I'm not getting cast. I wrote my own work. And that's just basically where it came from. But it's like this, it went down a deeper journey of discovering that my stories actually matter, like that they connect, that it's more for a larger than just my need to act or my need to perform, which is essentially like an identity, an existence. Yes, it's important. But there is also this larger need that others are connecting. And it's knowing through being an actor in training that you do store memory in your body, learning through science that memory DNA changes from trauma, learning that trauma leads to mental health issues that maybe aren't that great, you know, and where it could progress. The decisions that we make continue to put a groove in our brains depending on what we decide to think upon. All of those things, like, okay, people are connecting on this level. There's this need to tell this story because I see the power of story, because we're so taken, like those opportunities aren't really allowed. Our existence as many existence that we are, like myself being queer or masculine identified now too, and being Latina, like person of color, like I'm not supposed to exist a lot of times in certain spaces. And so this need is larger than myself. It's also for the audience that has that sense memory. We're not allowed sometimes to let that go. We're told, no, we work, we do this, we get up, we have coffee, we do this, we do that. When do we be, you know, outside of this capitalistic machine? Like, where can we be? And we can't become machines.
Right, right.
This is my way of, like, being human, like, right. Like, connection to others. And because of, like, I was, through the years of doing SER, that's why it's like, no, this story is more like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I'm telling the story. But it's like, well, I have enough experience that I could just say, okay, I'm ready, I can do it. Yeah, it's scary. Yeah, it's this. Yeah, it feels like, like, I'm going to go for it because I have witnessed how much it means for others. And that's one of the reasons why I did the documentary too. Just wanted to point out I'm doing a documentary about it because it started being about why is this process necessary? Why do I do this? I wanted to show others what it takes to put on that kind of work, the work that is a live theater solo play, mm-hmm. and
Where can people obtain more information about the documentary?
Yes. So for that, you can go onto my website as well. So it's karenanzuategui.com, KarenAnz, like zebra, OategUI.com. And there's information there. And then you can always write to me on Facebook. I have a Catholic School Days page as well. You can like that. And so it's two different things, a live show and the need that you ask, like, why I did the documentary as to why. And I follow others as the audience and participants throughout these years. I've been doing this since 2012 and performing it, what that effect was and how it affected their lives.
Well, I appreciate you joining me this morning. And, you know, for our audience, if you'd like to learn more about Karen, look at the links on our webpage. We included your FB. So I feel like so high school with that. I included your FB. Hey.
Hello.
Hello. No, I included your Facebook event page for Catholic School Days in our in the episode description. Also, for more information, I included your Facebook link as
well.
El Facebook. Sí. And so Catholic School Days is playing one night. It's a 60-minute show, and it's playing at the Art Share LA, that's 801 East 4th Place, LA, California, 90013. And for more ticket information, we've added the link also here in the episode description that's through Brown Paper Bag. And so if you have any questions, feel free to send us a message at LGBTHeroAwards.com. I'm your host, Xavier Mejia, and I'd like to thank Gaden for joining us. I'll be there. You know I'm going to be there. So
yeah.
It's going to be a fantastic night. I already know it. It's been a pleasure to have you here. And, you're always welcome to come back here, and I'm sure you have a lot going on, and in fact, I know you have a lot going on, but that we can't talk about just yet. Hold on to your seats, honey.
Yes.
This is Xavier Mejia with Queer Talk. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Queer Talk, LGBT Hero Awards.
Yay!